Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. With so much attention on Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, important down-ticket races are not getting much attention. In the House, Republicans overwhelmingly dominate, which suggests an unlikely shift in party control. But over in the Senate, Democrats need to keep the 46 seats they currently hold and win five more to gain a majority. If Hillary Clinton becomes president, Senate Democrats only need to win four more seats since the vice president is a tiebreaker. And then there are the state legislative and gubernatorial races across the country. Republicans control far more state governments, but partisan balance might shift in some states come November. Joining me to talk about key down ballot races from the Senate to state chambers are two guests. Dave Leventhal is senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonpartisan, nonprofit investigative news organization. Dave leads the center's federal politics reporting team, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Good to be back with you.
Good to have you. And David Neer is political director of Daily Kos, an online progressive community. David oversees the site's elections coverage and publishes the Morning Digest, which covers every competitive congressional race around the country. And Dave joins us from New York City. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, Rose.
Great to have you. So let's start off by talking about the Senate. You know, here in California, Barbara Boxer is retiring, and we are sending a new senator to Washington. It'll either be Kamala Harris or Loretta Sanchez, both Democrats. And unfortunately, this is not really getting much attention. So far, the debate dates have not been confirmed yet, so we can't let listeners know about those, but we will when they are confirmed. Dave Leventhal, it's really shocking to me. I mean, you know, if you search the LA Times, the Sacramento Bee, they've got an article here or there, but people aren't really talking about this important Senate race here in California.
These things are so temporal. I think 2 years ago, in 2014 midterm elections, and everything was about the Senate races, the battle for the U.S. Senate, who was ultimately going to gain control of the House and the Senate, and of course it went the way of the Republicans, but absent a presidential election, when that is the biggest game in town, that is the focal point. But of course we have this absolutely unprecedented presidential election here in 2016, and to use an adage I hate myself, but I'll use it anyway, all the oxygen has been completely sucked out of the entire nation in a way that leaves very little scant room for races like key House races or even U.S. Senate races to gain the sort of national prominence that that they would have just 2 years ago when we did not have Trump and Clinton, or for that matter, Trump and Clinton and 20 other candidates who were running at some point during the presidential election leading up to Election Day in 2016. So it's a very different situation, and as a result, you have the situation that you just described, with many of these very key races and very incredibly important races just not getting the headlines that they might.
And David Neer, what's interesting about what's happening here in California is a senator from California has one of the most high-profile political positions in the country. What do you think explains the lack of coverage on these important races?
In California in particular, you have a special situation where, as you noted, both of the women running are Democrats because of California's unusual top two primary system, which allows the two highest vote getters to advance to the general election regardless of party. And I think as a result, that's hurt interest in the race, because Republicans have no reason to even pay attention. In polls, most Republican voters say they're even going to skip that race. And it's too bad, because there is still quite a lot riding on it. In fact, what's so interesting about the race is not only do you have two women running against one another, but you have two women of color. So the number of women of color in the Senate, which of course has had extremely few over the years, is going to increase by one next year, no matter what happens. And Harris and Sanchez are both very different candidates. Harris is a real establishment Democrat. Sanchez has been trying to win support from Republicans. So it's definitely an unusual race. And I agree with Dave, though, that when you're running up against Donald Trump, it's very, very hard to get attention.
Yeah. So, David, what other Senate races are you watching? In the Senate, Democrats need to keep the 46 seats they currently hold and win five more to gain a majority.
So there's certainly a fairly long list of interesting Senate races for those who actually do want to delve down into the details. I would say that right now there are three Senate seats where Democrats are favored to win, to pick them up from Republicans. Those are the ones in Wisconsin, Illinois, and probably Indiana as well. So as you noted, it depends on whether Tim Kaine is vice president, whether the Democrats need four or five seats. But the next group of seats after that are, I would say, the Senate races in Florida, where Marco Rubio unexpectedly decided to run for re-election, New Hampshire, which is a real toss-up and has been from day one, and also Pennsylvania, where Democrats have come on strong recently, particularly because of Hillary Clinton's strength in the state. And then also Democrats are playing defense in one seat, which is in Nevada, where Harry Reid is retiring. So Democrats have to hold that seat in addition to having the four or five other pickups.
And Dave Leventhal, you do a great job of following the money, and there's so much money being poured into these races. So, for example, in Pennsylvania, outside spending groups have poured more than $20 million into Pennsylvania Senate race between Republican incumbent Pat Toomey and Democrat Katie McGinty, putting it close behind Ohio Senate race. So in Pennsylvania, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, $20 million has been spent so far.
And you have several key Senate races that have attracted already eight figures, a handful of them, and that number will grow between now and 60 days, roundabout, until Election Day on November 8th. Another one, you mentioned it earlier, but the New Hampshire Senate race, I think, is a fascinating one for a couple of reasons. Number one, that too features two female candidates who are running against each other, Kelly Ayotte, the Republican, and Maggie Hassan, the governor of New Hampshire, who's running as a Democrat. Against her. This has attracted a ton of national money pouring into Little New Hampshire because many Democrats feel, especially at the national level, that Hassan can beat Ayotte. Ayotte has been, although she is relatively popular in New Hampshire, she's been very, very slow to embrace Donald Trump. She's somebody who they see as vulnerable as a result, and the theory, the idea among Democrats is that if Donald Trump really flames out in New Hampshire, with him will go Ayotte if they can tie her closely enough to him. So that is a very competitive race, and that too is well above the $20 million mark just in terms of the outside money coming in. And when we talk about outside money, we talk about groups typically called super PACs, these groups that can raise and spend unlimited amounts of cash in order to advocate for and against candidates. This is really an after effect of the Citizens United decision that came down more than 6 years ago from the Supreme Court that really opened up new pathways for money to influence elections. And we're seeing New Hampshire, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, just some of the races, even Wisconsin and in Maryland, attracting significant amounts of money that in another year and another age of politics would have seemed almost impossible.
David Nair, the Koch brothers, have said they're going to spend $900 million on this election cycle, mostly on down-ticket races. What strikes you about who the Koch brothers are choosing to support for senator?
You know, it's certainly a lot of money, but at a certain point, you reach a point of diminishing returns because the airwaves get so flooded, and eventually people just start to tune out ads. So while that's an intimidating figure, Democrats have also done very well in terms of their own fundraising, and they certainly have super PACs backing them. And I think that we won't see too much of a financial disparity down ballot in the end. You know, the Kochs, in particular, obviously, the big story here is how they have shown no interest in Donald Trump. The question for both them and the Republican Party as a whole is whether you can really abandon your candidate at the top of the ticket and still convince voters to show up and vote for your down-ticket candidates. And that's pretty hard to do, especially in this day and age when elections are so polarized and very, very few voters split their tickets. In other words, very few are going to vote Republican for the White House but Democrat for the Senate or vice versa. And so if they really do cut off Trump, then they really do risk turning off voters who would otherwise vote down ballot. It's a very, very difficult dance for them.
Right. So you're saying that come November, the Democrats will most likely spend as much on down ticket races as Republicans?
I would hesitate to make quite that prediction, but I don't think that money is going to be the deciding factor. I don't think Democrats will be so outgunned that come November 9, we'll look back and say, oh yeah, it was money that killed us. You know, certainly, definitely a lot of liberals, of course, don't like the Citizens United decision. I don't myself. But I think that Democrats have shown a tremendous ability to stay competitive, particularly because they've done an excellent job with small dollar donations.
Dave Leventhal, how do you see it? When Jane Mayer was on the show talking about dark money, she reported that the Democrats and even moderate Republicans were blindsided in 2010 and even 2014 by a lot of very conservative Republican groups who just poured money into the campaigns across the country.
And that's correct. In 2010 and in 2012, you had Republicans very much at the vanguard when it came to the Citizens United decision. They were incredibly quick to embrace the new suite of rights and abilities that they had to use different types of political vehicles, to raise different types of political money, and then to use that money in different ways than perhaps they would have been able to prior to the Citizens United decision. So there was a certain novelty to it all that Republicans said, okay, we will sign up and we will use this every which way that we can. Democrats wanted to stand on principle against the Citizens United decision to a much greater degree and were much slower to embrace all the things that came with the Citizens United decision. Flash to 2016. That's all over. Republicans, Democrats, up, down, left, right, red, blue, it doesn't really matter much anymore. All of them have embraced the system as it is, even if many Democrats will still say, look, we hate the system. We hate Citizens United. We would love to overturn it. You hear Hillary Clinton talking chapter and verse about what she would like to do in order to have a constitutional amendment against Citizens United. None of that changes the fact that Democrats, whether it's at the presidential level or the congressional level, Senate, House, are using Citizens United to a very, very strong degree, mainly out of political necessity. They know if they ratchet down and they don't use it in the way that Republicans are, then they put themselves at political peril. And we saw in 2014, for example, the number one super PAC in terms of just ads that were being run during the Senate midterm races and the congressional midterm races was a Democratic super PAC. It was a Senate Majority PAC, which is incredibly active this time around again, too. So there's a heck of a lot of strength on the Democratic side, and it may not end up being 50-50, but it's going to be pretty darn close when it comes down to it in terms of the sheer spending, R versus D, Republican versus Democrat, in the outside money super PAC money game.
Dave Leventhal is senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonpartisan, nonprofit investigative news organization. David Neer is political director of Daily Kos, an online progressive community. He oversees the site's elections coverage and publishes the Morning Digest, which covers competitive congressional races across the country. And that's what we're talking about today, down-ticket races. Donald Trump is getting all of the attention, and these really important races across the country aren't getting as much here. Here in California, we're sending a new senator to Washington, D.C., one of the most high-profile political positions in the country. And so are you following this race between Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez? Again, the debates have not yet been confirmed. We'll bring you those as soon as they are confirmed. What other races are you following? There are other competitive races here in California and across the country. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. What about Senator Harry Reid retiring from his seat in Nevada? This contest is really important. It'll replace one of the body's longest-serving Democrats. And you mentioned this earlier. You've got Nevada Attorney General Catherine Cortez Masto, a Democrat, running against Republican Representative Joe Heck. And I understand the Kochs are pouring some money into this race. David Neer, what can you tell us about this one?
This race is very, very evenly matched. Both sides wound up recruiting pretty much their top candidates. Heck has done a pretty good job of avoiding a lot of the taint of some of the worst excesses of the Republican Party, and he's considered an able campaigner, though he has some baggage himself. Cortez Masto is often referred to as a Reid protege, and that this is sort of his last hurrah here to cement his legacy. And you mentioned the Kochs. As Dave was saying, you know, the money is going to be pretty even here. Democrats really, really not only don't want to lose this seat, but can't afford to lose this seat, because if they do, then that really sets them back in terms of taking over control of the whole Senate. The one interesting thing is that Donald Trump appears to be polling a little bit better in Nevada than he is in some other swing states. Part of that may have to do with the levels of education in Nevada. Among swing states, it has one of the lower levels of college attendance. The problem, though, is that we've seen very, very little independent polling of the state, so it's very hard to get a read on where things are going. But I would call that race very, very much a toss-up. And if Hillary Clinton does indeed carry the state like Barack Obama did the last two times, then I think the slight edge would lie with Masto.
And Dave Leventhal, anything to add about Nevada? Do we know what kind of Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto is, Nevada Attorney General?
Yeah, well, I think one thing to point out that speaks to what we were just talking about before was how expensive this race has become. It is definitely one of the top 10 and likely will end up one of the top 5 in terms of the overall amount of spending going into that race. So latest count had it around $17 million just in outside organizations that had been pouring money into this race, say nothing of the millions of dollars that the candidates themselves are spending. That's a heck of a lot of money for a state like Nevada. We're not talking about California or New York or Florida that has multiple major media markets. We're talking about, you know, Las Vegas and Reno, and you know, that's really about it when it comes down to it. So it's a huge seat. Obviously, Harry Reid looms large in this race, and as a result, a lot of interests that do not have Nevada in their address, but have Washington D.C. or even New York City or plenty of other places all around the country, have shown a high level of interest in this particular seat because it is competitive, because it definitely is a swing seat that is a toss-up and could very well be, if this is as close as some people think it's going to be, a state that could factor into tipping the balance of the Senate one direction or the other, Republican or Democrat.
And David Neer, have you been following the issues in Nevada? Do you know what kind of Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto is, or what kind of Republican Joe Heck is?
Sure. One of the most interesting ads, or series of ads, that Cortez Masto has been running has been on the issue of reproductive freedom, and in particular Planned Parenthood. Because as I was mentioning, you know, Heck has done a pretty good job of portraying himself as a moderate, but he's taken a number of votes in Congress to defund Planned Parenthood. Mm. And polling has generally shown that that's not a popular stance. And it's interesting that Cortez Masto has made that a centerpiece of her campaign. The rise in the strength of the women vote, I think, sort of speaks to why she is taking that direction. And that's definitely been one of the top issues on her side in this campaign.
And again, we're talking about the race in Nevada. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid is retiring. This is a very expensive race to replace one of the body's longest-serving Democrats. What about, let's see, how about Florida? Florida is going to be a showdown between Republican Senator Marco Rubio and Democratic Representative Patrick Murphy. Polls show Rubio is ahead, but Trump is trailing in Florida, which means Rubio might have a difficult time. Dave Leventhal, what strikes you about that race?
Oh, Florida's a mess, but would you expect nothing less during a presidential year? Not only is it a presidential swing state and one of the most, if not by the end, the most competitive swing state in the presidential race, with both Trump and Clinton just going absolutely crazy there, and outside groups getting in. But this particular Senate race has been lacking in drama, 0%. It's just incredible what has happened with this. And then Marco Rubio, of course, choosing at the end to knock out other prospective candidates to clear the way for him running for re-election. Patrick Murphy has a whole heck of a lot of political baggage, and that's going to be a very difficult seat for Democrats to hang on to. If I had to make a crazy prediction, that may be the one state that could cut one way, Democrat or Republican, and then flip in the Senate race going to the other party. It may just be that close on both sides, presidential and Senate, and you may have enough people willing to split their ticket, as rare as that is. And David's absolutely right. This is just not something that happens much anymore. Statistically, we're at kind of a low watermark when it comes to people willing to split their tickets. But if you're going to watch that happen anywhere in this race, Florida is a place to keep your eye on.
And David Neer, Marco Rubio, as many of us who watch the debates know, that he is a very conservative Republican. He's extreme on many issues. He is against abortion with no exceptions for rape or incest. What about Democratic Representative Patrick Murphy? What kind of Democrat is he?
He has represented a very swingy district in the House. In fact, it actually voted narrowly for Mitt Romney. So he's definitely more of a moderate. And there are certainly some progressives who, you know, find certain things not to love about his voting record. But Murphy's district is actually very similar as a whole to the partisanship of Florida on a statewide basis. So I think he's actually a good fit for the state as a whole. And I think that, you know, you mentioned the abortion issue. Murphy is adamantly pro-choice, and I would not be surprised at all to see Democrats go after Rubio on the issue of reproductive freedom, because he is out of step on that one in terms of the state of Florida.
And lots of money is being poured into this race. You've got the Chamber of Commerce spending $1.5 million opposing Murphy. Another group, the Florida First Project, $1.5 million supporting Rubio. What else stands out for you about money in the Senate race in Florida?
The real question will be, I think, how many other outside groups come to the Democrats' aid. Part of the reason, you know, Dave mentioned that this race had seemingly lacked drama so far, is that Florida has this very, very late primary. They only had their primary on August 30th. So the general election has only just begun. In fact, Murphy just went up with his first general election TV ad today. The union AFSCME is coming in for him as well. That was just reported. So I'd be looking out to see what other groups come in on the Democratic side to balance out those groups like the Chamber that you were mentioning just a moment ago.
And we mentioned Pennsylvania, lots and lots of money pouring into that race, $20 million. Dave Leventhal, what can you tell us about these candidates, a Republican incumbent Pat Toomey and Democrat Katie McGinty?
Yeah, well, Pat Toomey has been a known commodity in Pennsylvania going back years and years and years. In fact, when I was a intern at the Allentown Morning Call in college, I remember interviewing Pat Toomey on several occasions, and he's somebody who's been a political survivor and has made comebacks, and it's very difficult under any circumstance to beat an incumbent, whether it's for a House seat or a Senate seat, but definitely the Democrats in Pennsylvania think that the situation is ripe and that Hillary Clinton's coattails is going to help McGinty in a major way and is going to factor in to her ultimately being successful in defeating Toomey, which is why you see Democrats pouring so much money into this race in particular, because they do view it as something that can be a Senate pickup and some folks even think will be a Senate pickup, not only based on the strength of the candidate, but also the strength of the Democratic winds blowing in the direction of Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania.
And David Neer, what stands out for you about these two candidates in Pennsylvania?
Toomey, again, is one of these guys who has done a very good job of portraying himself as a moderate. He was one of the driving forces behind expanding background checks for gun buyers that failed in the Senate a few years ago. But he also has a conservative voting record, and again, to keep the theme going, particularly on the issue of abortion and Planned Parenthood. So I think that's definitely, once again, going to be a theme there. But I think Dave sort of alluded to this as well, that in these states where you have Hillary Clinton performing well, like Pennsylvania. There's no downside for someone like McGuinty to try to tie herself as closely as she can to the top of the ticket, because that split-ticket voting phenomenon, maybe Marco Rubio could pull it off in Florida. Pat Toomey is probably going to have a much harder time, simply because it looks like Hillary Clinton is going to win Pennsylvania by a larger margin than she's currently leading in Florida.
And I would just quickly add that McGuinty has a very strong environmental record. She's worked in environmental governance and politics for many years, and with fracking being such a big issue in Pennsylvania, this has been a key issue for her to latch onto and really press in a way that Toomey can't meet. It's something that's very much at the forefront of the minds of many Pennsylvania voters and can be a major selling point for her on the campaign trail.
Dave Leventhal is senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and David Neer is political director with Daily Coast. Today we are talking about important down-ticket races. After the break, we'll talk about two more Senate races in Wisconsin and Illinois, and then we'll move on to the House and talk about what's happening at the state levels. And if you'd like to join us, what races are you watching? We've got a lot of important ones here in California. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. On the telephone, by sending an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org, going to the yourcallradio.org website and leaving a comment there. If you'd like to participate in today's show by phone, you may call us toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up in a half hour at 11 o'clock, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. Amongst the other topics, we'll be talking about gun violence in Chicago. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the recently declassified documents about ties between the 9/11 hijackers and the Saudi Arabian government. The White House says the 28 redacted pages do not shed any new light on 9/11, but victims' families insist the 9/11 Commission did not fully investigate leads identified in the report. So we'll talk about what those documents reveal. And then tomorrow at 11 o'clock, it's our election special, and we will be discussing rent control measures on various ballots around the Bay Area. We will also talk about important pieces of legislation currently on Governor Jerry Brown's desk. Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we will be discussing coverage of resistance against the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. On today's show, we're talking about important down-ticket races. The presidential election is getting all of the attention, most of the attention. But what about important down-ticket races? What are you watching? What stands out for you? Are you paying attention to the Kamala Harris-Loretta Sanchez race? What about the race between Mike Honda and Ro Khanna in San Jose? That's a really important one. What other races are happening in your area? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And I know we've got a couple of callers on the line about gerrymandering. I just want to finish with two more Senate races, and then we'll get to your call. So please hold tight there. Dave Leventhal is senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and David Neer is political director of Daily Coast. And let's talk about what's happening in Wisconsin. Senator Russ Feingold is back. He's running again as a Democrat against Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Dave Leventhal, let's talk about that race.
Sure, and it's a great one, too, and a relatively rare one in the sense that you have two senators, one former, one current, running against each other, so that we talked a little bit before about how it's very, very difficult to beat an incumbent senator under any circumstances. You might put an asterisk next to that in the sense that that you have Feingold, who is a former senator, which makes it a heck of a lot easier for him to run a campaign that already has history. He already has sort of a machine and a network in place, even if it went dormant for a while. So that's one of the reasons why this is such a close race and a race that could ultimately go either way. And it's something that has to, because of the high-profile nature of it, because of the closeness of it, attracted to a lot of attention and a lot of money from outside of Wisconsin pouring into this one. It's been not the nastiest race in the country, but definitely one that's been very pointed, and you can draw some massive policy contrast between the two candidates.
David Neer, what stands out for you in that race in Wisconsin?
The most interesting thing to me is that of every poll of this race going all the way back to 2015, Ron Johnson, despite being the incumbent, has never led. And that's a very, very difficult place to find yourself in. In fact, a few Republican polls have come out showing him trailing, as though to say, well, he's only trailing by a little bit. And he's, I think, in a rather tough spot. Some of the outside GOP groups have canceled reservations or haven't followed through on planned ad reservations. And Feingold is in a very strong position, I think, to pick that seat up. And part of the problem is that Ron Johnson, he was elected in the GOP wave of 2010, but he seems to have misunderstood the fact that he represents a swing state, that he doesn't represent a red state like Wyoming, and has compiled a really, really conservative record, and is also very good at putting his foot in his mouth. So I definitely would give the advantage to Feingold on that one.
Hmm. All right, well, definitely watch that, because Russ Feingold was a favorite among progressives for many reasons, especially his taking on the Patriot Act when very few politicians would.
Absolutely. Feingold has a sort of special reputation among progressives, and of course, he was the architect of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, and obviously we were talking about Citizens United a bunch earlier. That's an issue that's definitely going to be at the forefront if Hillary Clinton wins the White House.
And in Illinois, which is a very blue state, according to reports, Republican groups haven't bothered making any ad reservations there, not spending much money. This is a race between Republican Senator Mark Kirk running against Democratic Representative Tammy Duckworth, who's a double amputee Iraq veteran. What stands out for in this race, David Neer?
So, as you mentioned, Illinois is indeed a very blue state. Kirk is a pretty savvy politician, but he also had the benefit of getting elected during the GOP tsunami in 2010, and he just looks like he faces demographics that he simply can't overcome. There are just too many Democrats voting in Illinois. We've seen very little polling of this race, but what we have has shown Duckworth up. But I think the point you made is the one that stands out the most. Follow the money. If Republicans aren't even bothering to come in with major ad reservations to defend one of their own, odds are he's in pretty poor shape.
All right, so that was the Illinois race. All right, so I think we've pretty much covered the Senate. Is there anything else either of you want to add about Senate races that we haven't covered, Dave Leventhal?
Well, I think we covered most of the bases on the Senate side. I would add, though, that there are some interesting races on the House side, even though it's unlikely that Democrats are going to be able to win enough House seats to make a credible case of getting control of the House going into 2017 and 2018. You definitely do see a number of Democratic groups that are making plays for seats all across the country. I think of one of the congressional races in New Hampshire, where Representative Frank Ginta, who's quite embattled, has been embroiled in scandals, including a campaign finance scandal. He not only faces a very difficult primary, which has not been conducted yet, that is coming up later this month, but then a very, very difficult re-election fight, and Democrats are pouncing on that race, trying to knock him out of his seat. You see another one, too, in the Democratic-Republican race in New York's 23rd congressional district, which features Representative Representative Tom Reed, who was a very, very early Trump supporter. Democrats are betting that John Plum, who's the Democrat in that race, is going to be able to kind of ride an anti-Trump wave in New York, even though that's a relatively conservative district, and knock Tom Reed off. You could point to several other great examples. I won't belabor it, but definitely it's worth noting that that there is some activity going on in some of the House races, again, even if Democrats don't have a whole lot of hope of winning the House overall this time around.
Now, you two are a wealth of information, and I wish you both would be on the cable shows more often, actually providing real information. We have an email about Senate races from Rachel in Berkeley, who says, for those of us Californians who hope to see the Senate flip to a Democratic majority, what are the most effective ways for us to participate this fall, given that tight races are in swing states? David Neer, what would you say?
So certainly there's always the option of contributing money to folks in out-of-state races. And if you don't have a ton of money at your disposal, which is, of course, most of us, I would look for the races that are maybe a little bit more on the bubble. And so there are a few that we haven't talked about yet. But, for instance, the Senate race in North Carolina or Missouri or Arizona, these are all sort of second-tier Democratic pickup opportunities. They haven't attracted the same amount of enormous outside spending that Dave has mentioned in regard to several races. At least they haven't done so yet. And so your dollars can go further that way. If you're in California and you want to help flip the Senate, and you have time on your hands, and you have a car or friends with a car, hook up with the Cortez Masto campaign in Nevada. It's a little bit of a drive, but they definitely could use your help out there going door to door.
You mentioned Arizona, and John McCain thought that he might be in trouble because he's not fully endorsing Donald Trump, to say the least. He did win his primary, but he thought he would be in trouble, and he usually doesn't. And he's running against a Democratic Representative Ann Kirkpatrick. David Neer, is John McCain really in trouble based on what we're hearing right now?
He definitely could be. You know, you mentioned that primary. He only won with 52% of the vote against a really, frankly, wacky candidate. And that was a weak performance by McCain. Hmm. And there is still this lingering distrust of him among the conservative base in Arizona. And that's shown up in the polls. Several polls have shown a really close race. The question will be whether those conservatives decide to come home in the end and hold their noses and cast their votes for McCain. They probably will, but right now we're only 2 months away and they're still saying they don't want to vote for McCain. So Kirkpatrick definitely still has a shot at an upset.
Wow. All right. Well, we've got a couple of questions from listeners about gerrymandering and Citizens United. So let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. And Ruth Ann, thank you for holding.
Oh, thank you very much for the show. I wanted to ask either of the guests if they had opinions about gerrymandering and what David Daley brought up in his book that Rose had him on, got a couple of months ago, talking about how putting the money aside and the Koch brothers and everything else, that the big deal in Republican upsets are their gerrymandering after the census every 10 years so they can lock in down-ticket races.
Right. Yes. So David Daley is author of the book Rat Effed, and he details how GOP operatives led gerrymandered districts, which paved the way for Republican control of the House and state governments across the country. He wrote a piece in Salon recently saying that Democratic House candidates will likely get more votes than Republicans, just like they did in 2012, but Republicans maintained an advantage. And then he writes, Trump is more likely to rebound in swing states than Democrats are to capture the 30 congressional seats they need to pry the speaker's gavel from Paul Ryan. What are your thoughts on this, Dave Leventhal? I mean, David Daley said that gerrymandering is going to be with us for at least another decade.
It will likely be with us for the duration of our nation. To some extent, it certainly has been for many, many, many decades, going back to the early history of our country. Don't want to be overly skeptical about that, but it's going to be very difficult for effectively the entire nation to change. This is something that is done at the state level, and as a result, you would need multiple states to get on board, and in order to change the way that the system system is. Gerrymandering is not my area of expertise, but what I can tell you from our reporting and from some of the great literature that you've cited in stories that have been written, studies that have been done, is that you have a situation now today that is more polarized than almost you've ever had in modern political history, in the sense that there are fewer and fewer and fewer House seats that are truly competitive. So going into a race, by the way that a district is drawn, by the composition of a district demographically and politically, you have very little room for a Democrat to win against a Republican, or for a Republican to win against a Democrat, because those districts are just simply so red or simply so blue. So it's definitely something, though, that I think you hear a lot more about gerrymandering today than even you did in 10 or 20 years ago, because a lot of people are just simply upset at that political reality. Whether anything is going to be done about it, though, remains a very open question.
Right. And I should say, what I meant is that David Daley said it would take at least 10 years for the Dems to actually make a dent with all the losses that they faced in 2010. Not that gerrymandering is going to leave anytime soon. But thank you for that correction. What about, well, and we'll talk about state races, because this is so, so important, right after we talk about the House. So all 435 House seats are up for re-election. The Democrats would need to flip 30 seats to regain the House. David Neer, it seems pretty unlikely that this will happen, right?
I would definitely agree that it's unlikely, but Dave sort of referenced something a little bit earlier, which is the possibility of Trump bringing new seats online for the Democrats that hadn't previously looked competitive. And there's sort of a theme to what those seats look like. They tend to be suburban areas that have been Republican generally in the past, but that tend to have higher than average education levels and higher than average median incomes. In other words, the kind of people who are most turned off by Trump's rhetoric. And if Democrats can start to put some of these seats in play, and we have seen some of them, in fact, get more competitive, a couple of districts in California, in fact, including the 25th District and the 49th District, then there's an outside shot. And I think, though, for Democrats to really have a chance of winning, I think that they would need Clinton to get back to the levels in the polling where she was a few weeks ago, when she was up 7 to 8 points nationwide. I think if Clinton could pull off an 8-point win nationwide, then I think that her coattails could be sufficient to flip the House. But yes, it's definitely going to be a difficult task. However, the odds are greater than zero. And if you asked me a year ago, I would have said they were basically zero.
Mm-hmm. And what strikes you about the Dems running and the Republicans running? In the past, we've seen a very conservative Republicans run for House seats and win.
Sure. You know, the reality is, as Dave was mentioning before, in terms of polarization, that most people are going to vote based on party label. And there's a good reason for that. People have busy lives. This sort of stuff is very complicated. And as you've noted, you know, so much attention gets paid to the presidential race that it's just hard, really, for your average person to really dig down and learn about candidates running for office. And so they go into the voting booth, or they get their ballot at home by mail, and they see a D after one person's name and an R after another person's name. And that's helped Republicans more than Democrats, I think, win elections, even when nominating very conservative candidates in more moderate districts, just because people are voting with the party label.
The LA Times has a really good piece called "Here Are the 12 Congressional Races We Are Watching." Voters in all of California's House districts will weigh congressional candidates this fall, but most of them are powerful incumbents. The state is represented in the House by 39 Dems and 14 Republicans. One of the races that's really important and everyone should be watching is the fight for what's happening in Silicon Valley. That's the 17th Congressional District. Representative Mike Conda, who's been in Congress for a very long time, faces a tough re-election fight against fellow Democrat and former Obama administration official Ro Khanna, who's receiving a lot of support from Silicon Valley executives and Silicon Valley companies. So you might want to keep a close eye on that one. Also, the Central Valley is in play. We'll put a link to this at yourcallradio.org. And maybe if you live in some of these districts or you have friends who do, you might want to send over this article. Today, we are talking about down ticket races with David Neer, political director of Daily Kos, an online progressive community. They've been doing extensive reporting on competitive races around the country. And Dave Leventhal, senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit news organization. Dave leads the Center's Federal Politics Reporting Team. They do fantastic reporting on money in politics. And speaking of money in politics, let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thanks for holding.
Yes, thank you. A comment and then two questions. One is keep an eye on Greg Palast's work on voter registration and the drives by Republicans to disenfranchise voters. There could be some surprises in November. The other question, or the two questions that I have to do with money and the debates. And I'm wondering, I know that, you know, the chances of getting Citizens United overturned are, I think, remote. We're going to be stuck with that forever. But what I'm wondering is what the states could do, what kind of mechanism the states could set up that might blunt Citizens United. And I'm thinking of something like this. This is sort of an odd idea. But, you know, when they run the credits on movies or whatever program on television, you see a list of people who are in the program. What I'm wondering is if somebody puts on a television ad, why they couldn't have to have a listing of anybody who made a donation of over $2,000 and run the credits or whatever, how you might do that. So I'm trying to think of a mechanism that the states could use to kind of counter Citizens United. The second one has to do with the debates. What states could do to ensure that people like Jill Stein or other candidates can get into debates and require a certain number of debates being held and get back to the point where, say, not presidential debates, but for Senate, local races, whatever, the League of Women Voters might get back involved in this and require public television in the state to cover debates and have inclusive debates. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. So let's first off take the question about money in politics. Dave Leventhal, what are your thoughts about ads, since we are all so bombarded with ads? And sometimes it'll say paid for by We Love Children. And you just don't know who these people are.
There's a decided lack of transparency around some of them. Much of our work is focused on and trying to out the actors, whether they're liberal or conservative, behind those particular ads. I'd point you to our Source Check project, which does exactly that. But to the caller's question, you have kind of two levels that we're talking about here. You have the federal level, which are congressional races, Senate races, the presidential race, where the decisions on what you would have to disclose and what you would have to put in terms of a disclaimer on the ad, that's done at the federal level, although it affects all 50 states with the races being federal races being run in those states. That being said, for gubernatorial races, state senate races, assembly races, races that might involve other statewide contests, but definitely at the state level, there's a lot that individual states can do and have done in order to either enhance disclosure, to make the process more transparent, or even to the issue of funding of elections. When the caller talked about blunting Citizens United, there have been some states and even localities that have experimented with things like democracy dollars. I would look that up. And different ways of publicly financing campaigns in order to, number one, get people more involved, and number two, try to, at least in the minds of some advocates for this way of doing things, to try to fight back against what might otherwise be big, moneyed, powerful interests that are either playing a major role or perhaps an outsized role in the way that the campaign is being run in a particular state.
And there is a measure in South Dakota, Measure 22, which calls for public disclosures of donors to campaigns and lowers contribution amounts. I just read about this on Common Dreams, and the Koch brothers are waging a war against this local effort to expose dark money. So there are some initiatives across the state. And, you know, Thank you for your question, Greg, about debates, but we're almost out of time, and I'd like to tackle that on another show because we're definitely going to cover the debates. I just wanted to quickly ask you both about what's happening at the state levels. I know you do not follow this closely, but this is so important because this is where so much of the action happens. We've seen a lot of anti-abortion legislation, the bathroom laws, the right to work laws. In 2010, Republicans gained about 700 new seats in state legislatures across the country. David Neer, what are your thoughts on what's happening at the state level?
Sure. You know, as our first caller alluded, the census in 2010, that was the absolute worst time for Democrats to get wiped out electorally. You never want to have a wave crash against you the same year that a census is being conducted because, as you just mentioned, Republicans took over all these state legislative seats. They won all these governorships, and then they held the pen when it came time to do redistricting. And getting back to the point that came up earlier about, you know, how long will Democrats be in the wilderness, they really have to focus this year, 2018 and 2020, on winning back state houses, winning back legislatures and governorships so that there is greater equality in terms of who actually gets to draw the maps next time. And this isn't something that Democrats are blind to. Republicans definitely had the upper hand in 2010, but the Democrats, led by the DLCC, which is the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee, they are the group that helps try to elect legislators, Democratic legislators nationwide. They have a project that's focused on 2020. Republicans do, of course, as well. It'll be a very closely matched battle, but that's really going to have to be the focus because I think that until the next round of redistricting, Republicans are going to have the advantage.
And Dave Leventhal, we have about a minute left, but since 2008, the Democrats have lost 910 state legislative seats, 30 state legislative chambers, 11 governorships. David Daley, in his book Rat-Effed, reveals that the Democrats really did not pay attention to what was going on at the state level in 2010. They were blindsided. Is that going to change in 2016?
They're acutely aware of it now and painfully aware of it, too, and they don't want to see a repeat or a continued sliding in the wrong direction for them. So, yes, they are investing a very, very large amount of resources into trying to reverse the trend, number one, and to make gains, too, going forward, not only in this election cycle, this coming up election cycle, but ones in the future as well. And I know we're out of time, but suffice it to say they are being very aggressive about this and no longer taking it seriously. Down.
Well, here's a good headline from MSNBC. Forget 2016. Democrats have a plan for 2020.
That would be very accurate.
Yeah.
They do. Whether it's going to work or not, that remains to be seen. But they're definitely trying to start early and start often and get this thing going so that they don't have a repeat of what happened last decade.
Dave Leventhal is senior reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. He leads the center's federal politics reporting team. And David Neer is political director of Daily Kos, an online progressive community. He covers every competitive congressional race around the country. David and Dave, you brought a wealth of information to our hour. So thank you so much for your reporting and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the recently declassified documents about ties between the 9/11 hijackers and the Saudi Arabian government. The White House says the 28 redacted pages do not shed any new light on 9/11, but victims' families insist the commission did not fully investigate leads identified in the report. So what do the documents reveal about what happened on 9/11? Tweet your questions to @YourCallRadio and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.